In our previous two lectures, we looked at the Supreme Court's rulings in cases that involved two groups that many Americans distrusted, the Jehovah's Witnesses and Japanese Americans. During a time of national crisis, as the nation approached and then became embroiled in World War II, members of these religious and racial minorities were considered potentially disloyal and even dangerous to national unity and military security. As we saw, the court shifted its position in the Jehovah's Witnesses cases, first upholding the power of local officials to expel witnesses from public schools for refusing to salute the American flag. But the court then ruled that the fundamental rights of witnesses and other minorities were beyond the reach of majorities, as Justice Robert Jackson wrote in the Barnett case. However, the court upheld the power of military officials to remove all Japanese Americans from the West Coast as a reasonable response to threats of sabotage and espionage. Now, I've reviewed these cases because it's important to recognize that the court's rulings were affected by two related factors. First, both the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Japanese Americans had long been subjected to discrimination and hostility. They had also been singled out by laws that imposed restrictions on their rights, those of the witnesses to preach their doctrines in public, and those of Japanese Americans to become citizens, to own land, and to practice various professions. The second factor that influenced the justices in these cases was the impact of wartime fears and passions. Writing for the majority in the Korematsu case, Justice Hugo Black noted that we are at war with the Japanese Empire. Black later said that people were rightly fearful of the Japanese during the war, even native-born citizens like Fred Korematsu. These two factors of longtime public hostility and of current wartime fears provide a context for the cases we'll first discuss in this lecture. These are cases that involve members of the Communist Party. It's fair to say, I think, that no other group during the past century has been more feared than American supporters of the Soviet Revolution. The nation has experienced two Red Scares, each following a world war in which disloyalty became a label for political dissenters and the advocacy of revolution became a criminal offense. We looked in previous lectures at the court's rulings in cases that involved communists after World War I, upholding their convictions for distributing revolutionary propaganda and for belonging to communist groups. The court held in these cases that the First Amendment did not protect the advocates of revolution. In this lecture, we'll examine another group of communist cases raising very similar issues during the 1930s and the Cold War period that followed World War II. We're going to focus on these cases for two reasons. First, because they produce some of the court's most important rulings on First Amendment rights. And secondly, because the Cold War that pitted the United States against the Soviet Union has been replaced with the current war on terrorism. This new form of warfare, waged by groups that have declared a holy war that spills across national boundaries, has claimed thousands of lives through terrorist acts, both in the United States and abroad. Whether the First Amendment should protect those who support these shadowy and militant groups is a question that will strain our tolerance of what Justice Holmes once called freedom for the thought we hate. We're going to begin our exploration of the First Amendment's limits in the years that preceded World War II. As we saw, the Communist Party was organized in 1919 by supporters of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. During the 1920s, the party made up in rhetoric what it lacked in numbers. In fact, by the mid-20s, the communist movement had lost 9/10 of its original 40,000 followers. The legal repression of the party had scared away many of its members, and the country's prosperity during this decade made its revolutionary message hard to sell. But the stock market crash in 1929 and the hardships of the Great Depression that followed in the 1930s made communism seem like an attractive alternative to what some people saw as the failures of capitalism. Between 1930 and 1935, the Communist Party grew from 7,500 members to some 30,000. This was still a small number, but the party made inroads on college campuses through the Young Communist League and among trade union members. Communists gained leadership positions and several unions that broke away from the conservative American Federation of Labor to form the more radical Congress of Industrial Organizations. Communists also found recruits among state and federal workers. The party's leaders even adopted a new slogan, "Communism is 20th century Americanism." Even the small number of American communists threw fear into conservatives. Beginning in 1930, members of Congress pushed for new laws to restrict the party's activities. Representative Hamilton Fish, a New York Republican, persuaded the House in 1930 to set up a special committee to study the communist problem. The Fish Committee submitted a report that recommended laws to outlaw the Communist Party and to ban its publications from the U.S. mail. But none of these proposals were enacted. In 1934, the House created another special committee, headed by Representative John McCormick, a Massachusetts Democrat. The McCormick Committee was instructed to investigate so-called un-American activities and conducted hearings that focused on communist influence in labor unions. The committee's report in 1935 stressed what it called the danger of vicious propaganda aimed at the subversion of those fundamental principles upon which our Constitution rests. The report called on Congress to pass legislation that would make it a federal crime to advocate the violent overthrow of the government. But the elections of 1936, which gave President Franklin Roosevelt a second term by a landslide, eased the fears of communist propaganda, and McCormick's bill died in the House Judiciary Committee. Now, I've recounted these legislative attacks on the Communist Party as background to a pair of Supreme Court rulings in 1937. Let me outline the facts in these cases. In the first case, a communist organizer named Dirk De Jong was speaking in 1934 at a party meeting in Portland, Oregon. The meeting had been called to protest the shooting of striking longshoremen by the Portland police. Alerted by handbills that accused them of shooting unarmed workers, police officers arrived to break up the gathering. They arrested De Jong for violating the state's criminal syndicalism law, which punished the advocacy of unlawful acts to promote revolution. De Jong was convicted and sentenced to 7 years in prison. The Oregon Supreme Court upheld his conviction, but the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously reversed this ruling in January of 1937. Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes wrote for the court and based his decision on the lack of any evidence that De Jong had advocated any illegal acts in his speech. His sole offense, Hughes said, was that he had assisted in the conduct of a public meeting, otherwise lawful, which was held under the auspices of the Communist Party. Hughes added that peaceable assembly for lawful discussion cannot be made a crime. Those who assist in the conduct of such meetings cannot be branded as criminals on that score. Now, we saw in an earlier lecture that the court had upheld the conviction under California's criminal syndicalism law in 1927, in the case of Charlotte Whitney, who belonged to a communist party. The Oregon law was virtually identical to California's in its wording. So why didn't the court apply the Whitney ruling as precedent in the De Jong case? Chief Justice Hughes explained that Whitney, as he put it, was found guilty of willfully assisting in the forming of an organization for the purpose of carrying on a revolutionary class struggle by criminal methods. Dirk De Jong also belonged to a revolutionary communist party, but none of the communist literature distributed at his meeting, Hughes noted, contained any advocacy of criminal syndicalism or of any unlawful conduct. Now, this may seem a narrow ground for distinguishing the two cases, since Whitney and De Jong clearly shared the same revolutionary goals. But in my view, Hughes was reflecting the greater tolerance of communist activities in the 1930s. He was willing to split judicial hairs to avoid sending De Jong to prison and creating a communist martyr to the class struggle. 3 months after this ruling, in April of 1937, the court also reversed the conviction of a communist organizer in Georgia. Angelo Herndon had been charged with inciting insurrection against the state. His real offense was being a black communist in a Deep South state and trying to organize other blacks into the party. Herndon was charged under a state law that made it a crime, as the law stated, to induce others to join in any combined resistance to the lawful authority of the state. The maximum penalty for insurrection was death, but the all-white jury that convicted Herndon had recommended mercy, and the judge sentenced him to 18 years in prison. The Georgia Supreme Court upheld Herndon's conviction and his sentence. The U.S. Supreme Court reversed this ruling. Justice Owen Roberts noted in his opinion that Herndon's organizing efforts consisted of holding three meetings for discussion of relief for the unemployed, making membership in a party and solicitation of members for that party a criminal offense punishable by death, Roberts wrote, is an unwarranted invasion of the right of freedom of speech. But the court's ruling was not unanimous. Four conservative justices, the so-called four horsemen of reaction, voted to uphold Herndon's conviction and sentence. These four justices had joined the decision to strike down Dirk DeJong's conviction. But DeJong was white and Herndon was black. There seems to me no other plausible explanation for their votes in these two cases. Willis Van Devanter, one of the conservative justices, wrote a dissenting opinion that reeked of racism. It should not be overlooked, Van Devanter wrote, that Herndon was a Negro member and organizer in the Communist Party and was engaged actively in inducing others, chiefly Southern Negroes, to become members of the party. State officials had found literature in Herndon's room advocating self-determination for the Black Belt, the party's slogan for an independent black nation in the Deep South. Despite the fact that none of this literature called for violent revolution, Van Devanter concluded that Herndon's efforts were, as he put it, nothing short of advising a resort to force and violence, for all know that such measures could not be effected otherwise. Now, we saw that political factors most likely affected the court's rulings in the DeJong and Herndon cases. Congress had established two special committees in 1930 and 34 to investigate communist activities. But none of the legislative proposals to outlaw the party or ban its publications from the mail had been enacted. And the party gained more recruits and more public sympathy after the Nazi regime in Germany began a full-scale attack on communists, imprisoning thousands and murdering party leaders. The exploits of American communists in the Spanish Civil War, fighting in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade against rebel forces that were armed by Germany, also generated support for the party as an anti-Nazi group. But this support abruptly ended with the signing of the Hitler-Stalin Pact on August 24th of 1939, 9 days before German tanks rolled into Poland. This alliance between the Nazi and Soviet government caused many American communists to quit the party in disgust. It also prompted Congress to pass a new sedition law, known as the Smith Act, after its House sponsor, Representative Howard Smith of Virginia. Modeled on the World War I sedition law that had expired in the early 1920s, the Smith Act made it a crime to advocate the overthrow of the government by force or violence. The law also banned the publication or distribution of revolutionary literature. Congressional support for the Smith Act was so great that it passed the Senate by unanimous vote and the House by a margin of 382-4. Ironically, the first victims of the Smith Act were not members of the Communist Party, against whom the law was directed. In fact, party leaders cheered when the federal government prosecuted members of a rival group, the Socialist Workers' Party, and sent 18 of them to prison in 1942. By this time, Germany had broken the Hitler-Stalin Pact by invading the Soviet Union, which joined the Allied coalition against the Nazis. American communists quickly replaced their red flags with the red, white, and blue and dropped their attacks on President Roosevelt. The Communist Party even dissolved itself in 1941, reforming as the Communist Political Association. Its literature avoided any calls to revolution and rivaled the American Legion in patriotic rhetoric. But the political scene changed abruptly with the death of President Roosevelt in April of 1945 and his replacement by Vice President Harry S. Truman. The new president approved the dropping of atomic bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August, and the war ended with the unconditional surrender of the Axis powers. But the victory celebrations were hardly over when Soviet troops moved into Eastern Europe, bringing down what Winston Churchill called an iron curtain across the continent. President Truman denounced the Soviet occupation, and American communists denounced him as a warmonger. The Communist Party resumed its old name in 1945, and its leaders launched an unrelenting attack on Truman's foreign policies. Ironically, leaders of the Republican Party charged that Truman wasn't hard enough on the Soviets, putting the president in a political vice. Caught between the left and the right, Truman faced a tough battle for a full term in 1948. The Communist Party made his uphill campaign even steeper by supporting the Progressive Party candidate, former Vice President Henry Wallace, who urged closer relations with the Soviets. And Truman faced an electoral threat on his right from the segregationist campaign of Strom Thurmond of South Carolina. Public opinion polls showed the president trailing his Republican opponent, former Governor Tom Dewey of New York. Truman moved to neutralize the soft-on-communism charges in July of 1948. Attorney General Tom Clark announced the indictment of 12 of the Communist Party's national leaders for violating the Smith Act by advocating the overthrow and destruction of the government of the United States by force and violence. The list of defendants was headed by the party's general secretary, Eugene Dennis. Federal prosecutors, aided by FBI agents, had compiled a brief against the party that included 846 documents. But government lawyers faced a problem with this evidence. To comply with the statute of limitations under federal law, the defendants were not charged with any illegal acts before 1945, when the Communist Party had been reconstituted. But they had made no revolutionary appeals since that date. Now, the bulk of the government's evidence came from the writings of Marx, Lenin, and Stalin, published between 1848 and 1929. The government's case was based on a syllogism. These foreign revolutionaries advocated the overthrow of capitalist governments. American communist leaders circulated their writings to the party's members. Therefore, the defendants intended to overthrow the American government as soon as possible. Whatever the logical flaws in the syllogism, the government's strategy worked. The prosecutors had three advantages at the trial of the communist leaders, which began in New York City in March of 1949. First, government lawyers were able to pick jurors whose loyalty had been confirmed by FBI agents. Second, the federal judge who presided at the trial, Harold Medina, made no secret of his sympathy for the government. And third, the lawyers for the communist defendants were more intent on picking fights with Judge Medina than picking holes in the government's evidence. The defendants took the stand at their trial and denied any intent to overthrow the government. They pointed to the party's constitution, which had been adopted in 1945. It subjected members to expulsion for conspiring or acting to overthrow the institutions of American democracy. Government prosecutors countered with their chief witness, a former party official named Louis Budenz. Over objections from defense lawyers, Judge Medina allowed Budenz to tell jurors that communist leaders used what he called Aesopian language as window dressing to protect their revolutionary aims from prosecution. Judge Medina's ruling placed the defendants in a catch-22 situation. Their disavowal of revolutionary acts proved their intention to commit them. After 8 months of testimony, it took the hand-picked jury just 8 hours to return guilty verdicts against the communist leaders. Judge Medina imposed 5-year sentences on all but one defendant, who had been awarded the Distinguished Service Cross in World War II and who received a 3-year term in reward. For good measure, Medina got the last word in his courtroom arguments by sentencing 5 defense lawyers to jail terms for contempt of court. After a federal appellate court upheld their convictions, the communist leaders brought their case to the Supreme Court in 1951. Before we move to the court's decision in Dennis versus the United States, we'll first look at the major changes on the bench. Every justice who voted in the DeJong and Herndon cases in 1937 had departed through death or retirement. The five justices named to the court by President Franklin Roosevelt after those decisions, Hugo Black, Stanley Reed, Felix Frankfurter, William O. Douglas, and Robert Jackson, have been joined by the four nominees of President Truman. He first picked a former Republican senator from Ohio, Harold Burton, to replace Justice Owen Roberts in 1945. Truman crossed party lines in naming Burton, but the two men had worked closely in the Senate. Burton left the court in 1958 without having written a single opinion of any significance. He was later ranked by scholars as one of the court's failures as a justice. The death of Chief Justice Harlan Fisk Stone in April of 1946 gave Truman a chance to provide the court with strong leadership. But he made another poor choice in naming Fred Vinson of Kentucky to replace Stone. Actually, Vinson's record in public service looked impressive. He had served in all three branches of the federal government as a congressman, federal judge, and as Treasury Secretary in Truman's cabinet. In naming Vinson, Truman lauded him as capable of unifying the Supreme Court and thereby improving its public image. The court badly needed a better image, as personality clashes and political ambitions among the justices had broken out into bickering. Justices Frankfurter and Black sniped at each other in nasty conference room arguments, and an ugly public fight erupted when Justice Jackson accused Black of blocking his nomination as Chief Justice after Stone's death. Fred Vinson was affable, but he failed completely in leading the court and restoring its battered image. The few opinions he wrote lacked both substance and style. One biographer noted that Vinson delegated this job to his law clerks and did all his writing with his hands in his pockets. The weakest Chief Justice of the 20th century died suddenly in September of 1953, shortly after the court heard arguments in the historic school segregation cases. We'll look at these cases in a later lecture, but it's fair to say that Vinson could not have shaped the unanimous opinion that his successor, Earl Warren, secured through firm leadership and personal magnetism. Justice Frank Murphy's death in July of 1949 gave Truman a third chance to shape the court. He turned again to his cabinet, naming Attorney General Tom Clark to replace Murphy. Clark was a native Texan and spent most of his career in government service, with 10 years in the Justice Department. Clark helped Truman win the vice presidential nomination in 1944 and was rewarded with the post of Attorney General. As a justice, Clark consistently voted for civil rights plaintiffs, but he supported the government in most criminal and national security cases. Clark's opinions were dull but competent, and he devoted much of his time to improving judicial administration. He retired in 1967 when President Lyndon Johnson named his son, Ramsey Clark, as Attorney General. Truman's final judicial appointment was also his worst. Justice Wiley Rutledge died in September of 1949, and the president named another former Senate crony, Sherman Minton of Indiana, to replace him. After Minton lost his Senate seat in 1940, President Roosevelt rewarded him for political loyalty with a federal appellate judgeship. He served for 8 years without distinction before Truman promoted him to the Supreme Court, where he served another 7 years without distinction. Minton well deserved the failing grade that scholars placed beside his name. Now, it's interesting that Harry Truman, who was consistently ranked among the top 10 presidents, named four justices who can fairly be described as mediocre. But Truman had a bad case of cronyism in making appointments, and the court suffered as a result. The communist defendants in the Dennis case also suffered from Truman's judicial choices. The court decided the case on June 4th of 1951, upholding the Smith Act convictions by a vote of 6-2. President Roosevelt's three most conservative justices, Felix Frankfurter, Stanley Reed, and Robert Jackson, joined three of Truman's justices in the Dennis case. Justice Clark, who had authorized the communist prosecutions as Attorney General, did not participate in the decision, although he would certainly have provided a seventh vote for the majority. In my view, It was likely, or at least probable, that the ruling would have gone the other way if Chief Justice Stone and Justices Rutledge and Murphy had remained on the court and had joined with Justices Black and Douglas. But the court's most fervent defenders of First Amendment rights had lost their judicial allies to Depp and were relegated to dissent in the Dennis case. Chief Justice Vinson wrote for the court and warmly embraced the clear and present danger test some 30 years after Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes had fashioned it in the Schenck case. Vinson also borrowed the fire metaphor that Holmes had used in that opinion. There was a hot war raging in Korea when Vinson wrote his opinion, and newspaper headlines had read, Scorched Earth aids Chinese-Korean drive, on the day the Dennis case was argued. Vinson read the papers with alarm, and he cited the inflammable nature of world conditions to support his ruling. The Chief Justice gave a broad definition to the terms in the clear and present danger test. Obviously, he wrote, the words cannot mean that before the government may act, it must wait until the putsch is about to be executed, the plans have been laid, and the signal is awaited. Vinson's use of the German word putsch, which means revolt in English, was a thinly veiled reference to the failed Nazi uprising against the German government in 1923. And Vinson clearly intended to warn that American communists, although small in numbers, might pose a similar danger of an armed revolt. He put his warning in these words, an attempt to overthrow the government by force, even though doomed from the outset because of inadequate numbers or power of revolutionists, is a sufficient evil for Congress to prevent. Vinson brushed aside the fact that all the evidence against the communist leaders consisted of speeches and writings, which their lawyers contended was protected by the First Amendment. Vinson deferred to the legislative judgment, as he put it, that certain kinds of speech are so undesirable as to warrant criminal sanction. The communist leaders, he concluded, were properly and constitutionally convicted for violation of the Smith Act. Justice Black was inflamed by Vinson's opinion. The Smith Act, he wrote in dissent, is a virulent form of prior censorship of speech and press, which I believe the First Amendment forbids. Black stressed that the communist leaders, as he wrote, were not charged with any overt acts of any kind designed to overthrow the government, but had been convicted solely for their speech. Black ended his dissent with this lament. Public opinion being what it is now, few will protest the conviction of these communist petitioners. But he expressed hope that, in calmer times, when present pressures, passions, and fears subside, this or some later court will restore the First Amendment liberties to the high preferred place where they belong in a free society. The passions and fears of the Cold War period subsided very slowly, and the court has never overruled the Dennis case. But Justice Black got some measure of satisfaction in 1957, when the court reversed the Smith Act convictions of Oleta Yates and 13 other second-rank communist leaders. Justice John Marshall Harlan wrote in Yates v. United States that the Smith Act was directed at the advocacy of action, not ideas. The government had offered no evidence the Yates defendants had advocated revolutionary action. Justice Black wrote these words in his concurring opinion. The First Amendment provides the only security that can preserve a free government, one that leaves the way wide open for people to favor, discuss, advocate, or incite causes and doctrines, however obnoxious and antagonistic such views may be to the rest of us. As we've seen, the Supreme Court turned down the appeals of communists during the Truman administration. This was a group that most Americans considered antagonistic to our national values of democracy and equality. In our next lecture, we'll begin our discussion of the court's commitment to democracy and equality for members of another group, Black Americans. This chapter in the court's history begins with the story of a remarkable man, Thurgood Marshall. It's a story of courage and commitment to the values that shaped his life and that remain alive in his legacy to all Americans.